This is Audible.
Highbridge, a division of Recorded Books, presents George Washington, A Life in Books, by Kevin J. Hayes, read by David Colacci. Preface. After I parked my bicycle and pitched my tent at a roadside campground in the Blue Mountains of New South Wales, a man with a grizzled mustache stepped from a camper parked nearby. He asked me inside for tea and bickies, as Australians call cookies. Never one to refuse another's hospitality, I accepted. As we sat ourselves at the tea table inside his motorhome, he introduced me to his wife, and I introduced myself. They could tell by my accent that I was from America. He told me they had motored around Australia countless times, but had never traveled overseas. Both admitted they knew little about the United States. Practically the only American they could recall by name was George Washington, so they asked me to tell them more about him. This incident occurred during a 5-month solo bicycle tour of Australia, my last great adventure before starting graduate school at the University of Delaware. In other words, it occurred before I began studying colonial American literature with the world's leading expert in the field, before I became fascinated with the history of books, before I decided to devote my professional career to the subject of early American intellectual life. Asked to provide an impromptu biography of George Washington, I struggled for something to say, not having studied the history of the American Revolution since, gulp, the 8th grade. I was hard-pressed to fill in the facts for my kindly Australian hosts. Gathering my thoughts, meager as they were, I mentioned the time Washington crossed the Delaware, an iconic moment in American history. The episode was familiar to me mainly because Mom and Dad had bought me a scale model of the event based on the renowned painting by Emanuel Gottlieb Leutze. I can still smell the enamel and glue I used to reconstruct that singular moment in American history. I nearly exhausted my supply of fiery red to paint the lining of Washington's cape as it flapped and fluttered in the wind on that raw and gusty Christmas night in 1776. Next, I told them about the brutal winter of 1777-78, the winter Washington and his men spent at Valley Forge, a place I encountered firsthand during a car camping vacation that took our family on a tour of numerous battlefields and historic sites. The stone farmhouse at Valley Forge, where Washington made his headquarters, stands out in my mind. Having previously heard stories about hardship and privation and frostbite and starvation among the Revolutionary soldiers at Valley Forge that winter, I found the farmhouse a little too cozy. At the time, I wondered why Washington was not sleeping in a tent like his troops. Later, I was relieved to learn that Washington did sleep in a tent with his men when the Continental Army first came to Valley Forge. Though he enjoyed the finer things in life, Washington had the sensitivity and the sympathy to understand when it was time for him to make personal sacrifices and suffer the hardships others had to suffer. Long before our family vacation, Mom had urged us children to save our allowances so we could afford a few special souvenirs. At the Valley Forge gift shop, I purchased a small bust of Washington, which went on my bookshelf after we got home. That boyhood souvenir sits on my desk today. After telling this Australian couple about how Washington crossed the Delaware one winter and spent the next at Valley Forge, my mind went blank. I visualized that tiny bust of Washington back home, but it was mute. After briefly mentioning Washington's presidency, I just plain ran out of facts. Stalling for time, I took another bite of Bicky. After chewing that digestive biscuit once or twice, or maybe thrice, I suddenly remembered the dollar bill in my wallet, the only folding money I had not converted to Australian dollars. I took out the bill and used the engraved portrait of George Washington on its obverse as an emergency visual aid. I spoke of Washington's meticulous dress and his concomitant sense of decorum, his clenched lips and firm resolve, his calm eyes and penetrating gaze. If this good-natured Australian couple noticed that I had stopped providing them with facts about George Washington and started interpreting his portrait, they did not complain. They seemed genuinely pleased with what I told them. By the time I finished, the sun had almost disappeared below the horizon, and Washington's face appeared hazy in the dusk. Leaving their camper to return to my tent, now barely visible in the gloaming, I felt embarrassed that I could not say more about the man known as the father of his country, the father of my country. The present work, therefore, represents my second attempt to tell the story of George Washington's life. This new version is much different from the one I told around the tea table in that camper in the Blue Mountains. It is also much different from the numerous other book-length Washington biographies that have appeared at an astonishing rate over the past few decades. They, too, tell the familiar Washington stories, crossing the Delaware, wintering at Valley Forge, serving as president. In other words, they relate his active life as a soldier and a statesman. George Washington, A Life in Books, on the other hand, tells the story of his intellectual life, examining the man through the books he owned, read, and wrote. 100 years ago, Ezra Pound criticized American history textbooks for ignoring Washington's intellect. Pound's critique still applies. More often than not, Washington has been seen as a shelf filler, someone who decorated his home with books but seldom read them fully or deeply. Here's an alternate theory. Although George Washington never assembled a great library in the manner of, say, Benjamin Franklin or Thomas Jefferson, he did amass an impressive and diverse collection of books that he read closely and carefully, and that significantly influenced his thought and action. No one has ever written an intellectual biography of George Washington. Learning about my task, one historian sought to discourage me, asserting that the documentary materials simply do not exist to tell such a story. Unlike so many of the other founding fathers, he argued, Washington left little record of his intellectual life. Benjamin Franklin wrote a famous autobiography, among many other occasional pamphlets, essays, and letters, all of which dramatize his lifelong interest in reading and writing. Thomas Jefferson's voluminous correspondence and his massive library provide access to his mind. And John Adams recorded his agreements and disagreements with authors in the margins of his books. Though Washington's surviving comments about books and reading are not nearly as extensive as those of other founding fathers, he did leave many different types of evidence that, in the aggregate, can help to reconstruct his life of the mind. The evidence takes many different forms. Surviving books. Though Washington's library was widely dispersed during the 19th century, many of his books do survive. The Boston Athenaeum holds the single largest collection of books formerly in his possession. Additional books survive at Mount Vernon. Other libraries, the Firestone Library at Princeton University, the Houghton Library at Harvard University, the Library Company of Philadelphia, the Library of Congress, the Lilly Library at Indiana University, the Morgan Library, the New York Public Library, the Virginia Historical Society, all hold books from Washington's library in their collections, most of which I have examined. Marginalia. With the notable exception of his copy of James Monroe's View of the Conduct of the Executive of the United States, Washington's surviving books contain little marginalia, but he did write in his books occasionally. Most of the time he did so to correct typographical errors, but sometimes his marginal notes reveal how he read. Occasionally his notes in one book indicate other books he read. The fact that Washington wrote in his books has gone largely unnoticed, because uncovering these notes requires work that some find tedious. One must examine the surviving books meticulously, turning over one page after another in search of the slightest pencil marks, showing that Washington did read the volumes that bear his bookplate. Library catalogs. Much evidence survives to identify books from Washington's library that do not survive. Mainly, it comes in the form of library catalogs. Washington himself compiled two such catalogs, which not only list what books he had at Mount Vernon, but also demonstrate his level of bibliographical expertise. Lund Washington, his cousin and plantation manager, compiled a list of books at Mount Vernon toward the end of the Revolutionary War. Washington's library was inventoried with his estate after his death. When many of his books went up for sale in the 19th century, the booksellers described them in considerable detail. All these various catalogs provide much additional information about Washington's books. Published writings. The story of the books in Washington's life includes not only those he owned and read, it also includes those he wrote and published. Washington was a reluctant author, but sometimes his professional responsibilities compelled him to publish what he wrote. Occasionally, editors, both friends and enemies, took charge and edited Washington's writings, especially his letters, for publication. Several chapters in the present work concern books Washington authored that were published during his lifetime. Correspondence. As a writer, Washington was at his best when he was writing letters. Like any good letter writer, he shaped his tone and persona to suit individual readers. Though he seldom discussed his reading with his correspondents, sometimes he did provide bookish advice, especially when it came to recommending what military manuals to read or what agricultural manuals were useful. Washington's correspondence, which fills dozens of volumes in the standard edition of his papers, contains numerous references that shed light on his books and reading. His literary allusions are often subtle, and many of them have gone unnoticed previously. Diaries. Washington kept a diary through much of his life, but his individual diary entries are frustratingly brief. He says where he was and what he did, but seldom does he reveal the inner man. He rarely mentions what he read or what he was thinking. Every once in a while, he does provide a tantalizing clue indicating the importance of one particular book or another. In Chapter 7, for instance, I reconstruct the story of how Washington used a book of farriery in his library to try and save the life of a favorite horse that had broken its leg. Extracts, abstracts, and notes. Washington filled many blank quires of paper with notes he took while reading. Some of these notes come from practical manuals. Others come from books of history and travel. Several of these notebooks survive at the Library of Congress. Amounting to a total of nearly 900 pages, Washington's manuscript notes supply a wealth of information about his reading process. Other notebooks survive in fragmented form. The owner of one such notebook disbound it and distributed its individual holograph leaves to friends. Now only three leaves from the original notebook survive. The image of George Washington as a man of letters is much different from the accepted image of George Washington as a man of action. Like any new interpretation, this new view may take some getting used to, so I ask the listeners patience and indulgence. The story of Washington's intellectual life can be quite exciting. So pour yourself a cup of tea, put some bickies on a plate, settle into your favorite chair, and enjoy this new take on Washington's life. Kevin J. Hayes, Toledo, Ohio.